Hey friends, and welcome to Typology. I'm Anthony Skinner, producer of the show, and we want to congratulate Ian on the success of his new book. The Road Back to You, An Enneagram Journey to Self-Discovery, has sold nearly 100,000 copies in its first year. And more importantly, we wanted to thank you for helping to make that come true. If you haven't read the book yet, go to Amazon, iTunes, or wherever your local books are sold and grab a copy. Now moving along, we've got a great show for you today, a really, really great show. But before we get to that, here are a few things that you'll want to know. First, if you're new to the Enneagram and want to learn more about it, go to the podcast page at www.typologypodcast.com. That's typologypodcast.com, and download a free chapter from Ian's book, The Road Back to You, titled Finding Your Type. Or if you'd rather listen to a quick introduction to the Enneagram rather than read one, you can download and listen to our very first episode titled Introducing Typology and the Enneagram on the podcast page as well. Second, while you're on the Typology website, visit the About page and take the introductory Enneagram assessment to start the journey toward identifying your Enneagram number. Finally, at the end of the show, Ian offers a few practical suggestions relating to the number that we discussed this week, so be sure and listen all the way through to the end. And now, I'd like to give a shout out to a few of our Patreon supporters. Michael Wilson, Christy Brazelton, Monica Albin, Brenda Baird, Barry Pierman, Lynn Elgin, Andrew Fail, John Bryant, Amy Thompson, Julianne Reeder, Amy Mills, Deb Fair, and Anna Chapa. Your contributions are so greatly appreciated. Thank you. If any of you out there would like to help out as well, you may go to www.patreon.com/typology. And now, here's the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Hey, Typology Tribe, this is Ian Cron, and I am so excited today to welcome my friend, the singer-songwriter Matthew Perryman Jones to Typology. Matthew released his debut album, Nowhere Else But Here, in 2000, and he's released three additional albums since. They're Throwing Punches in the Dark, Swallow the Sea, and Land of the Living. Some of his songs have been featured in films and TV placements. We'll talk a little bit more about that. And today he's here to talk to us about life as an Enneagram 4. So let's get to it. Matthew, welcome to Typology.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled today because I, like you, am an Enneagram 4. And so I'm hoping that you can help figure me out during our time together. When did you first encounter the Enneagram?
About 17 years ago, I was on tour with our friends Don and Lori Chaffer.
Oh, boy.
And they had the Richard Rohr book, and they were reading it, and it was a point of discussion, and I was immediately fascinated because I've always been fascinated with personality stuff. And so and this was totally new. I'd not heard about it, and had a funky weird graphic design on the front that was intriguing. And so I started reading about it, and in reading some of that, I read about the four and immediately resonated with a lot of what I was reading.
Well, first of all, you were with Don Chaffer, again, right. A mutual friend, amazing songwriter, mm-hmm. He's just a fascinating, amazing human being, right? Mm-hmm. And boy, what a four. What was it like for you to be on tour with Don Chaffer? Were you like in a bus together? I mean,
We were in a van together. It was just the three of us. And we were just hopping around the country. I think at the time I had not known them really well at all. They asked me to hit the road with them, and I love them immediately. And you're right, Don is sort of the four to the core. Both he and Lori are just wonderful characters, mm-hmm. and Don especially, he's the louder character for sure. But yeah, I was immediately drawn to them. And Don is just a one of a kind, for sure.
So for our folks who don't know perhaps the Enneagram as well as others, the Enneagram fours are called the individualists, sometimes the romantics, sometimes the tragic artists or the tragic romantics. Mm. How would you, if someone said to you, so Matthew, describe what a four is, how would you describe fours to other people?
Mm. Wow. Oh, geez. How would I describe a four? I mean, I've always seen fours in particular of just having I would say one, mainly just a very rich internal life. People who are very much living inside themselves. If that makes, I know it makes sense to you. Yeah. So just very internal people, having a very wild and rich interior life. And so I think that initially is sort of a hallmark of a four. And naturally with that, a lot of creativity and sort of a sensibility to aesthetic and beauty and meaning and all of that stuff. That those are sort of the hallmarks I pick out when if I were to describe a four, what is a four, or to pick them out, which I guess you're not really supposed to be doing, but you kind of spot it. You know, people who have a very acute sense of beauty and interpreting that beauty in a mm-hmm. way. I guess that's part of the internal thing, I think. Mm-hmm. I would say, I don't know. Is that a good job?
Yeah.
I don't think it's just the artist, because I know people who are not artists, and I think that's a misunderstanding a lot. If you're an artist, you must be a four or whatever.
Right. Well, I always laugh and say, you know, if you go down to Greenwich Village or here in Nashville, 12 South, you'll see a lot of threes dressed up like fours.
Yes, threes and sevens.
Yeah.
I've always said that in this town, there's a lot of threes and sevens and a handful of fours. I think the more I learned about four, the less I wanted to be one.
I know,
or to
yeah.
be, I think that's part of the deal when you start to really dig in and you see the ugly side,
right.
And you're kind of put off by yourself in mm-hmm. a way. You're kind of like, Jesus is so true, and how annoying is this? You know, I mean, I think that's usually, I've heard that that's usually a good sign, is when you start reading the non-positive sides of a number and you get viscerally reactive to it. Like, gosh, that's why it's like usually a sign, like that's right
yeah.
there. That's right inside yourself.
Yeah, it's getting too close for comfort,
yes.
right? Yeah. So one of the things that I think it's important for folks to know about is that fours experience themselves as people who are missing something essential at their core, that mm-hmm. there's something in their makeup that's absent. There's something that therefore everybody else has that they don't, mm-hmm. that allows them to live in the world in a way that's more comfortable than the four, you know? Mm-hmm. And the four usually can't name what this missing piece is, what this tragic flaw is at the center of their person. It's vague. It's mm-hmm. it's nameless. They just feel like I'm different. There's something about me that disqualifies me from belonging in the world. Mm-hmm. So it's always this nose pressed against the glass experience. Mm-hmm. For fours. Is that what you mean by is that the way that your interior world feels? And
for sure, yeah, I guess that is one aspect of the darker side of the four, I suppose, is that sort of that missing piece, that mm-hmm. sense of not belonging, not getting the memo. That's, I've said that a lot. I just
not
feel like
getting the memo.
I just didn't get the memo. I
oh
feel
my
like,
gosh, that's an amazing
line.
I
feel line. Like everyone in this room got the memo and I didn't. Like, I just, I don't.
That's one of the best things I've ever heard.
But I think that's kind of one of the things is that I personally have felt that most of my life that I can remember. Is a sense just, and it's exactly how you put it. It's sort of vague. I don't know exactly what it is. Can't put my finger on what that thing is, but I just know I don't have what everybody else in this room has. Whether, you know, it's just a way of being, just a sort of a way of being in the room. I feel like I don't know. I don't have what these people have and whatever that is. I don't know. I still haven't been able to answer that really.
Yeah. Richard Rohr says that fours have a secret shame, which I always think is a helpful term, turn of phrase, you know, to describe the interior life of fours. Mm. Beatrice Chestnut, the phrase, and this was the moment when I knew I was a four. Mm. Yeah, she described fours as having a sense of irredeemable deficiency. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, that is precisely how I felt as a kid growing up, that I was lacking something other people had, and that, you know, it was a, you know, kind of a, I don't want to say, it was a kind of a feeling of being cursed somehow. You know what I mean? Like what is it that I'm missing that prevents me from living comfortably and happily in the world like everybody else? So if I were to talk to your parents or your siblings, how many siblings do you have?
Three. I'm one of four.
All right. So if we had to sit down with your family, you know, like a little intervention for Matthew, and I said to him, tell me what Matthew was like as a kid, what would they say?
Ah, interesting. It's funny. I was just at my sister's for Thanksgiving, and we had some of these conversations just about being kids, and she was talking a little bit about me, and I have three daughters, and I was like, you know, which one of these reminds you of me? And my middle, Naomi, she was like, definitely Naomi. She's like, you were the quiet sort of one sort of in the background a little bit, always just kind of observing and but also, you know, very engaging and not, I was shy for, I mean, it's funny. I was shy and I wasn't shy. I had this sort of strange thing where I could go and talk to a group of people at the beach as a kid and had no qualms about that. But then other situations found myself very shy. But I guess if my family would describe me growing up, I guess age-wise, I mean, if you're talking as a kid, I was definitely a quiet kid. I had also had this sort of entertainer streak, like a sort of a desire to bring something enjoyable, which kind of looked seven-ish, I guess, if you were to, you know. And actually, it's funny. I've had a lot of friends who, growing up with me, said I looked more like a seven growing up, in the sense of how I kind of had this sort of lust for life thing. I could look like a seven. I wasn't driven out of, I don't think, what a seven would be driven by, but I think not to get off track too much, like fours and sevens have some similarities in that there's some lust for life, and I think fours have that, and I think that's partly why they're drawn to each other. But as a kid, just to myself, very much I was always creative in some way, either creating a puppet show or picking a guitar up and strumming it. I was always sort of doing something outward and sometimes flamboyant when I was a kid. I kind of lost that along the way, but when I was a kid, I was way more flamboyant and open and kind of wild and stuff. But then there was this other part of me that was very quiet to myself. And then as I got older, you know, my teen years, I would say internally, I felt that very much so. I think that's when that sort of missing piece really became pronounced, was in my teen years, that sort of, I do not fit anywhere. And I was sort of a misfit kid. I hung out with sort of the miscellaneous crowd in high school and, you know, the John Hughes sort of, you know, the misfit John Hughes people. I mean, that was my era, and those were the people I hung out with. And I even then didn't quite feel like I fit.
You mean like in Breakfast Club, the movie Breakfast Club?
Yeah, Breakfast Club or Pretty in Pink or some kind of, I mean, I was a John Hughes junkie. And that was my era. That's when I grew up, and that's when I was in high school, was that whole time. And that I related to that so much. But yeah, I was definitely in sort of the ducky crowd, or the, you know, the Eric Stoltz crowd, when in Some Kind of Wonderful, that sort of side, marginalized, you know, I call it the miscellaneous crowd. Just kind of, you have people that nobody's really following the one thing. It's just a bunch of kind of turkeys, you know, hanging out with each other. So I definitely was in that crowd, and even then didn't feel like I kind of fit in anywhere. I didn't feel like I had a place. And again, identity was a big thing too. What was my identity? Who am I? What's what's my thing, you know?
Yeah, and that's true of all those three numbers in that heart space, right?
Hmm.
The twos, threes, and fours all have issues around identity. And that's why all three of those numbers project images.
Hmm.
Right, so twos project, the helpers project this image of the affable, likable, chirpy, you know, how can I help you? Flattering, complimentary, you know, type who can often be smothering and intrusive when not very healthy.
Hmm.
Threes projecting an image of competency, of success, of, you know, and fours projecting an image of, you know, uniqueness and specialness, of course, which is the underlying motivation mm-hmm. of the four, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a need, a compulsive need to be special or mm-hmm. unique. They relish in it.
Mm-hmm.
And they embrace that identity. I mean, that is part of the identity, is I'm the special one. I'm the unique one, you mm-hmm. know? And they put that image out there because they think that that's the key to that will solve the problem of their mm-hmm. missing piece, you mm. know. It's a compensatory gesture, right? Mm. If I can just be unique and special enough, maybe then I can get off the aisle of misfit toys and be mm. welcomed into community where mm. I belong. Of course, the problem is that the harder you try to be unique and special, the less likely it is that you're ever going to be brought back in right. into the group, because people are going right. to be looking at you like, you know, you really are outside the group.
Right. Right.
You know, it's like sort of a self-defeating, yeah. you know, strategy.
You create it, yeah.
Well, you feel you're on the outside like Ducky, but at the same time, you sort of find yourself wishing you were Ducky, right?
Of course. You love Ducky. He's so lovable. Yeah. Yeah.
So the passion of fours is envy. And that mm-hmm. makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're always comparing yourself to other people, which fours are always doing, mm-hmm. and you're looking around and you're thinking, gosh, everybody else seems to have what I'm missing, and therefore their lives are happier than my life is, mm. and they're not suffering. They don't suffer as much as I do. Everyone else's life is easier than my life, you know? I mean, fours get addicted to their suffering.
Sure.
And I can yeah. look back at phases in my life, man, yeah. where I was deep into my own
absolutely
suffering as like a Jones, man. It was uh-huh. like an addiction, right? Uh-huh. So what's envy like for you? Like, what's been like cool. the history of envy in your life? Is that color the water of your interior world, envy?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I at first I was like, I don't think I'm a very envious person. I had to kind of explore that a little bit, and I realized, oh geez, I am so much that way. I mean, I see, and it, I think it is part. It's tied to that thing of what, they have it. They have that thing, whatever that is, or they seem to kind of easily move in the world, and I can't. And so and then I see the what I perceive the fruit of that being in other people, whether it's success or, you know, likability or whatever it is, I perceive that other people are more likable than me because of whatever this ease is that they have that I don't have. So yeah, I realize a lot of times I have compared myself. I didn't think it was like a conscious thing where I was like, envy's my thing, but it is. I mean, it's a subtler thing for me. Or I've buried it so deep somehow. But I guess in my life, what does that look like? To be honest, I find the people that I'm most irritated with or annoyed with, I could trace it back to that very thing. I'm envious of them. And I have a couple people in mind right now that I just kind of go, I have this, like, I just don't like them. When I've sat with that before, it became very clear to me that it was definitely an envy thing. Mm. I was jealous or envious of something that I perceived that they had that I didn't. And so, I think a lot of times that's a sign for me. It's usually things when I'm a little put off by somebody, I start to ask myself that question. What is it about this person that I might be envious about? Mm. And 'cause I have found that that's usually kind of the root.
Yeah. And you're actually just, you know, sort of highlighting something that is great about the Enneagram, just in terms of transformational work, you know, is it begins to like give language to some things. Right. And so, you know, if you know the Enneagram, you know, you're a four, you start to feel afflictive emotions or, you know, you feel negatively towards someone, you can stop and ask yourself, am I envious right now? It's just because you know that's part of the pattern, you mm-hmm. know, like, is this somehow or another linked to my struggle with the passion of envy. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm totally envious of people. I mean, I can, you know, it's hard for me actually to, you know, always, I can catch myself now, you know, mm-hmm. like going, oh, I know what this is, mm-hmm. you know, partly because I've also learned to identify what envy feels like in the body. Mm. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think like if you start to do some advanced Enneagram work, I think you do start to realize, okay, when I feel certain things, I actually do feel them in certain places in my body. Hmm. You know what I mean? Like it's like a sensation in my chest or in my bottom of my throat. I'm like, oh, I know what that is. Hmm. That's
where
envy.
Do you find that envy exists in your?
I tell you right where it is.
Experience.
It's right here. What is this? That my solar plexus? What is that? You know, it's like this is going to sound all new agey and weird. Yeah. But literally I can know that feeling, that emptiness, that feeling of it's like a craving feeling, you know, which is like, I want what you have feeling. And I feel lesser than because you have it and I don't. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And I really, sometimes when I'm working with people in counseling in the past, I'll say, where does that exist in your body? Because your body doesn't lie. You know, it keeps a score, right? So I can just say, man, oh, I know that feeling. And then I can look at it and go, and I never prosecute it. I just look at it and go, oh, hey, how you doing?
Mm-hmm.
I see you. And, you know, is what you're saying to yourself right now, is it true?
Mm.
You know, and I can just sort of let it go. But yeah, envy's a very powerful creature, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the older you get, the more disguises it shows up in, you know?
Yeah.
I felt it bad in high school. Did you feel it bad in high school?
Definitely in high school, for sure. Yeah, very much so.
Golly, I grew up in Greenwich, Connecticut, this super wealthy town, and we had a family that, my family had been very wealthy at one time, lost everything due to a series of bad decisions on my father's part. But I can remember looking at all the other rich kids and on their lives and constantly thinking, why did we lose it? Why? Mm. You know what I mean? Like there's that abandonment and loss theme that runs through the lives of kids who are fours. And it sounds like, was that, when you look back on your life, can you sort of pick out a moment and say, that's where this suspicion that I was missing something began?
Mm.
Is there like some paradise lost moment where you think that might have been contributed to your becoming a four?
Hmm. Interesting. I've never really thought about that. Immediately what comes to mind is I grew up in Levittown, Pennsylvania until I was about 10 or 11. We moved to an Atlanta suburb. And I would say at that point in my life is when I felt the missing piece thing most pronounced was when I was 10 or 11 and I went into a new public school and I was not in sort of I went to a private school in when I lived in Pennsylvania. My mom was a teacher there. So we kind of grew up very much just shepherded along and everything. And there wasn't really the moment of kind of being kind of thrown in the middle of a general sort of, room of people. I was just with people who all went to a private school and wore the same shirts.
Right.
And there wasn't really any of that sort of obvious, social distinctions, if that makes sense. And so going to a public school for the first time when I was 11, I think was the first time I felt that the most, clearly is this sort of, I don't know what it is, but I don't know how to integrate into this group of people in any way. I felt very much like an outsider. And naturally, I think to some degree, most people would feel like an outsider going into a new situation like that, but have maybe an easier time integrating than I did. It took me a while. And I think at that point actually was when I really, my mom was very much like needed me to look neat all the time. And I hated it. I mean, ever since I was a kid.
Was your mom a one?
I don't think so. I'm still a little puzzled with my mom.
Let's just end the interview right there. I think everyone's going to relate to that right away. Let's go to our sponsor.
A little puzzled by my mom. I was always, when I was a kid, my mom wanted to brush my hair that way, and I would immediately just mess my hair up, or they'd pull my tie up, and I'd pull it down, and I just could never I never felt good being tidied up. Never. And I hated it. And so as soon as I got to public school, you know, my mom's still trying to buy me clothes. And I was just like, forget it. And I went in and I started to develop my own thing. And I was a skateboarder. I started skating. I was obsessed with skateboarding. I started to, you know, grow my bangs out long. And I shaved the side of my head. Because I remember there was one, this is totally off the path. But I remember one time my parents would, they would take me to the barbershop. And I told them, I was like, no, I want my bangs to be long and you can cut up the back. And they just went in and clipped all my hair off. And I remember at that point, I was like, I had a big, just like, nope, that felt like such a violation. I felt like I told you how I wanted you to cut my hair. And this sounds so petty as I'm talking about it, but I was 10 or 11. And I remember I was like, no, this is how I want my hair to look. And they were like, nope, you're a young boy, you know, and they clipped all my hair off. And that's probably why to this day, I don't cut my hair. It's just like, it's probably something I really have to work on. But I do remember at that point in time, I was like, no, I'm going to do my thing. And I remember I started becoming like just a militant individualist, just like, I'm going to do my thing.
Okay, so this is like a big theme for Forrest, which is authenticity. Mm-hmm. I have to be my own self-expressive, you know, human being. So I often ask Forrest, you know, what was your... Actually, it was with Anthony, who's in the room here, my producer, engineer. His wife, MK, is a four. And one night, but she was unsure she was a four, right? Hmm. So we're... I'm asking her a bunch of questions. We're around a fire pit one night. We're trying to get her type, you know, and she's going all over the map. And after about 2 hours, I go, what's your favorite book in high school? I said, you tell the story of how we figured out MK was a four.
Well, to begin with, it was hilarious because she's so four, she couldn't be typed, right?
Yeah, well, this is a great point.
She hates the test. Don't put a test on
it. Oh, no. Fours are the type on the Enneagram that most resists being typed. Hmm. It is. I mean, it's just a fact. If someone says to you, I'm not one of these types, you know, I don't have a type, I go, oh, no.
I can tell you what type.
I can tell you what type you are. So go ahead and keep going.
Right. So it was about an hour or two in, and all these little clues started to fall into place. And then finally, Ian asked the question, in high school, did you read Catcher in the Rye? And she said, oh, not only did I read it, I carried it around with me every day. And he was like, score! And put both of his hands up. Touchdown! It was just like, yeah.
Well, then when I told her, she says, well, why didn't you ask me that first? You know, but it saved us 2 hours. And I was like, well, but the reason is because fours so identify with Holden Caulfield, who hated phonies, who was very, very fixated on authenticity. So the whole barber shop experience, you know, really speaks to, you know, a big moment, you know, this is what I want. This is who I am.
That's why it felt profoundly violating to me, even though you feel like it's a haircut.
Right.
Like big deal. But to me, it was like, no, this is me. This is what I want to be. And this somehow is a huge violation of that.
Yeah. So this envy thing, this missing piece thing generates kind of like, we're not hard to disappoint. I like to say, you know, it's not hard to disappoint a four. You know, and it's not hard to arouse a sense of dissatisfaction in a four, which leads to a lot of melancholy. Right, we're prone to melancholy. Mm-hmm. Are you a melancholic person?
Yes, I mean it's funny. I to some degree don't consider myself being. I have certainly have times and seasons in my life where I was profoundly melancholic. Generally, I don't. I guess maybe I've become a bit healthier, but friends of mine would say absolutely melancholic, like somebody who's withdrawn, sort of in themselves. And I don't think of myself as moody either, but I have friends who are like, no, you have these things where you go into this dark space all of a sudden, or you're kind of, but I don't feel that I'm that way personally, but I do get that feedback a lot that I'm perceived specifically melancholic. And I suppose that I am. Maybe it's such a part of myself. It's sort of like, you know, asking the fish how the water is. It's
exactly.
Like, I don't know, just kind of, this is where I live all the time.
That's right.
You know, But yeah, I definitely have, I identify very much with anything that's melancholic. I'm drawn to it.
Right.
I have always been, like poetry and literature that falls more on the sad side of things. I just, right. and it's not sad to me.
Right.
It's actually food.
Yes. Okay. So this is big because I actually had somebody the other day at a workshop. I think they were concerned about a four and they raised their hand. And they said, can you tell me the difference between melancholy and depression? Because I can't tell if this person in my life is either, are they melancholic or the depression? It's like, how would you answer that question as a four who is well acquainted with melancholy, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the difference? Mm. How would you describe it?
How would I describe
how would you describe the difference to help someone understand a four? Because what I just said is it's food. Like you just described something actually pleasurable, not something oppressive. And
I guess describe the difference between being depressive and melancholic is that I think depressive feels more circumstantial and sort of environmental. So it has to do more with what's going on, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe that sounds a little too, like, I think melancholic is just a kind of a dispositional thing where it's like a little more with, well, I guess when I say withdrawn, I mean kind of the ability to go into oneself and sort of mull over stuff and, mm-hmm. and maybe to some degree ruminate on things that are not positive. And I think that's I think it's part of the missing piece thing.
Yes.
Is sort of going into oneself and sort of exploring what that might be and finding, like, kind of going into the abyss and looking around. And I think fours do that a lot. I certainly do. I live in, I think is what's perceived as being melancholic, or super sober. And, you know, and I do have that element of it, but I have, I'm not like that. I'm a very optimistic person. I think, I don't think I'm pessimistic. but I'm not afraid of sadness or darker sort of shadowy things. I just am not. I'm drawn to it. And in people I find myself in conversation, I'm always looking for that in them. Like, where's the shadowy part? Like, what's the, I'm obsessed with wanting to know that because I don't know. I haven't thought too much about it, but you know, maybe I'm trying to find what that thing is in them that they're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
That is that, I don't know how to explain that really, but I just am drawn to that. And it's not a sad thing. I think it's very strange. I don't know how to explain that. It's
kind of home for you a little bit, right?
It does. It feels so very much at home.
It's like you're finding a point of connection.
Right.
With someone else.
Yeah, I can remember as a kid, people would say, why don't you cheer up? And I'd be like, I'm not unhappy. Like, I didn't, like I'd be like, well, stop it. You know, it's like, actually, when I sit around and I would, you know, I don't know, I can remember, I had older brothers and they were 10 years older, so they were quite a bit older, and they were the ones who introduced me to music.
Hmm.
And they had great taste in music. And but I could sit around and, you know, listen to, you know, records that were really pretty kind of dark, you know what I mean? But I felt happier than it was. But what it aroused in me was moving into that space of where, what is the meaning of life? This depth, this sort of space of the more transcendent space. I wasn't, it's like what Victor Hugo says, right? Melancholy is the happiness of being sad.
Mm.
And that's,
that's great.
Right.
There you
I
go.
Mean, that's
end of conversation.
To me, that's what I felt like. It was a happy sad.
Yeah. And I've like ever since, again, people have made fun of me for this, but like my favorite instrument on the planet is the Illen pipe.
I knew.
Which is probably very poor of me. But I,
you know, while you're on the Aran Islands, smoking a clove cigarette and
a
drinking
Peterson pipe,
oodles of bourbon. Yeah.
I have, and maybe this is some other thing, like some strange like Irish connection, but Celtic music has always felt like my soul. Like,
yes.
I've told people, like, if you want to know what my insides feel like, there's a piece by Davy Spillane. He's a well-known Illen pipe player from Ireland. And there's a song piece that he does called Midnight Walker. And I was like, if you want to know what my soul feels like, this is it right here. It's got the Illan pipe for me, as I would describe it, which I think is the instrument of a four, I would say. I'm mm-hmm. going to dub it the instrument of four. It has this ability to kind of tremble in these deep places that's where you kind of feel this ache, this longing. And then it moves into this transcendent, beautiful, but it bends when it's getting there. It's not like a straight note. It's like it bends and it cracks and it has all this stuff. When I hear that instrument, I hurt inside in the best way possible. I could listen. I would turn it on and have people like, what's the Titanic music, dude? Like, what's up with this? Like, this is the most beautiful music ever. Yeah, the Illan pipe. It's immediately Titanic, you know, reference. But, but yeah, I think... that represents sort of this feeling inside that sound. Some people hear it as sad, you know, almost funeral music. And I don't hear it that way. I think it's such beautiful, achy, and longing. I guess that's another aspect of maybe the four personality is sort of, and again, it's all tied to this missing thing and longing for, you know, that missing piece, right? And
the unavailable, the unattainable, the right. unachievable,
right.
that which...
Oh, geez, you're going into a whole nother world if you go talk about that whole obsession. But, you know, yeah, it's that...
Well, it kind of facilitates a feeling too, right? To me, like that whole, all that music helps to facilitate...
Yeah, it ushers you into something that I personally have great connection
yes.
to. And I could live in that. I just, that's that ache, that movement, that ability to kind of go deep and to also to kind of, to move into higher places. Like all of that, I think represents the interior life that I've experienced and certainly people that I know to be a type four personality. I think that is the landscape. Inside the inner landscape, so to speak, is this sort of rolling hills and beautiful places and meadow, just sort of a. It's
you're going to use the word meadow, weren't you?
I did. I kind of stopped myself, but yeah, I need to get out of the Irish meadowy.
No, but I completely understand. I mean, if you know, I think I even say this in my book that if you had given me a choice as a kid at 15, do you want to go to Disney World on an all expenses paid, or do you want to go to the north of Ireland and sit on a rock and write songs and smoke cigarettes in the rain?
Yeah.
Which would you have more fun? I go, there's not even
no question.
This isn't, I don't even need to. Yeah. I'm going right to Ireland, right? Now a seven looks at me like my son and he's like, what are you thinking? You know, it's right. like, we're going to Disney. Nah, right. I'd much rather go to Ireland and sit on the rocks in the rain and, listen
totally
to Van Morrison
to
sing Into the yes. Mystic and yes.
Yeah,
like go into my inner world.
I get it.
Oh my gosh. So
speaking of music and songs,
yes,
I believe we're gonna have Matthew sing us one, right?
Yes. Yeah, well, we were gonna have Matthew play a song, weren't we?
Yes.
That might even capture this. Do you have a
I
song
can do
for
that.
Us?
I do. I have a song called Oh Theo.
Oh, Theo.
That I wrote this actually with our friend Don Chaffer to bring him back into the conversation. I was writing for Land of the Living and my record Land of the Living a handful of years ago. And I had a long standing obsession with the person of Vincent van Gogh, as they say.
A true, a real four.
A real
maybe
four.
Maybe the patron saint of all fours.
Yes. Indeed, yeah. I was always and drawn to him as a person, and what I knew of him as an individual, I was just I don't know. Always just had a strange sort of I couldn't call it a kinship, but something that I related to in him. And I had a friend years ago give me the book Dear Theo, which is just a collection of letters that he wrote to his brother Theo throughout his life. And just got a deeper glimpse into this really unique, beautiful soul that I feel was wildly misunderstood in terms of, you know, growing up, you'd hear he was the guy who, the crazy artist who cut his ear off, right? And that's sort of what you knew of Vincent Van Gogh, the artist, was this guy who cut his ear off. And then you kind of dive into the way he saw the world and how he perceived things and how acutely he paid attention to what was around him, and was troubled to some degree. And I think those who are aware and pay attention deal with the consequence of that, which is the beauty and the terror, right? It's sort of all of it. And so I think that's why I was drawn so much to him, is he seemed to represent that way of living, of being so aware. So I, at some point, felt I had to write a song about it. And I invited our friend Don in, because he's a brilliant writer and lyricist, but also a dear friend. And I was really struggling with how to whittle this down into a song. And so we sat in my studio at the time, and Don sat, well, actually laid across the couch in his, like, some crazy socks he had on. And we would literally write lyrics down. I would sit a lot of times when I'm singing or writing, I'll just sing, you know, gibberish, and just disconnected words and stuff like that. It's kind of, I call it speaking in tongues. I just kind of start singing.
Word salad.
Yeah. And Don would sit there and it sounded like you said, da, 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 da. And he'd start something. And then we'd sit there and write lyrics on 3x5 cards and just kind of throw them at each other. Like, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? It's great. It's great. So we kind of whittled it down together, and I finished the song, O Theo.
All right. Well, let's hear it.
Under the silence of water, into a sky full of birds, out from the land of our fathers, I am falling on your words. Dark as the night of a preacher, I made a bed out of hay. They paid me a handful of money, but I gave it all away, all away. And the righteous raise their stones, and the devil threw his arrows. I was longing for a home with nowhere to go. In the half-light of the city, she took off all of her clothes. I flew from the height of the mountain into the valley of dry bones, all alone. And my heart was still unknown. I was drunk and full of sorrow. I was longing for a home with nowhere to go. Oh, Theo. I set fires of starlight to burn up against the despair. I was caught in the tangles of midnight's long unanswered prayer. Are you there? In the light of morning rose on a field of fallen sparrows, I was longing for a
nowhere to go.
Well, Matthew, that is an extraordinary song, and
thank you.
If really, you just gave people such a snapshot or a picture of the worldview of a four. There's so much longing in that song, so much empathy for Vincent in the song, and what you've done so beautifully there is what fours can do for people in general. Which is, you made it safe. You took people, almost like Virgil in Dante, right? Dante's Virgil. You were a guide. You helped bring people into a space emotionally they would not either know how to go by themselves, because it's not a very safe space, you know. But you said, "Hey, come with me for a few minutes. I'm going to show you an emotional landscape that maybe you're not familiar with, but you should be. And I'll make it safe. I'll take you there." And it was just exquisite.
Thank you
for it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Wow, I'm not sure we can say much else except that song is just. And I'll say another song of yours that I love is the song "Land of the Living," which was featured on the soundtrack for Manchester by the Sea.
Oh, the trailer.
Yeah. Right. Okay, but I have to say something about Manchester by the Sea, because first of all, this is a four story. I think people will appreciate it. Okay, so last New Year's, my son Aiden and I, now Aiden's a seven, we were, New Year's Eve, we're by ourselves, we're in Connecticut in a town where we really don't know anybody else, and, you know, we had no plans, we had nothing to do, nowhere to go, and he's a seven, and he's like, you know, Tigger, he's like bouncing off the walls, we got to go do something. I said, well, let's go to the movies, right? And he's like, oh yeah, let's go to the movies. So I took my son on New Year's Eve, a seven, to see Manchester by the Sea.
Okay. What a downer.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here we are. There are two people in the movie theater. Gosh. It's New Year's Eve. First of all, no one in their right mind would go see Manchester, except a four, right? Yeah. Now, at the end of the movie, I've got tears coming down my face. I am wrecked in the most wonderful way. I've had the best New Year's Eve of my entire life. Mm-hmm. He is sitting next to me like saying, I need a drip bag of Prozac. This is the worst thing. It just goes to show you how different numbers see the world so differently. For me, I was kind of in heaven. I mean, it was such a poignant film. It was the feeling, the landscape of the feelings in it were so genuine. You know, the whole thing just rang true to me. Now, for a seven, it was a disaster, right, in some ways. Now, he's smart enough to say, yeah, beautiful performances. Well, you know, he's a very smart kid. He's not, you know, a shallow person. But for me, I just felt so satisfied. It was food. Now, for other people, that would be more like a disaster, you know, experience. So anyhow, I just had to mention your
songs.
That
movie is a gut puncher for sure.
That film is?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, you go in knowing it's going to be sad, but then they have this whole other aspect that you're not expecting, and it's the gut punch.
Mm-hmm.
But it is. It's a fantastic film.
By the way, speaking of forest films, have you seen Lady Bird yet?
I have not.
Okay.
No.
Have you seen Three Billboards in Ebbing, Missouri yet? That film? Yeah. Okay, these are two films, by the way. Those of you who are listening, these are two amazing films, and they'd be really good films for fours to...
Okay.
If you want to know a little bit, there's some fours in both of those films that are worth...
Loving Vincent as well.
Which I missed the other day going with you guys.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Right. I've heard that it's all done with illustrations, right? It's all
painting.
Animation,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, all painting. I think there were 66,000 paintings to make the film.
Oh my gosh.
It's crazy. It's really fantastic.
Well, we can't finish up on fours until we talk about feelings and relationships, right?
Oh, geez.
Okay. Let's start with feelings for a second, right? Now, we were talking about how twos, threes, and fours all struggle with identity. And one of the sort of the places fours get their identity from is from their feelings, right? They're in their feeling triad, the heart triad. But unlike all the other numbers, fours don't just have feelings. They are their feelings. Mm. You know, that's a hallmark feature of fours, right? They are all into their feelings. And of course, that affects relationships pretty dramatically. Mm. We're known for being tumultuous, high maintenance, right? When we're not very healthy. So I have a question for you. If I were to, I'll make this easier for you. I'm not going to make it your girlfriends, but if I were to get all of your ex-girlfriends into a room, and we'll say friends in general, how's that?
But, sure.
And I said to them, okay, this is a support group for friends of Matthew, former girlfriends of Matthew. What would they say it was like being in a relationship with you?
Oh, geez. I'm going to have to call myself out on the carpet. I mean, I don't know, but I would assume, and I, you know, honestly, I never dated a whole lot, so I haven't dated a ton of people, but,
Well, it could just be friends too.
I would say, intense, I guess if that's one word that, people have used to describe me, it would be intense. I would say more so in my 20s. I would definitely have been described as intense. I could not hold a casual conversation with people.
Yes.
And I had to learn the value of small talk. I couldn't have small talk. And actually a girl I dated at the time would comment on that. She's like, you can't just have small talk with people.
Nope.
I'm like, I'm not interested. I will Irish exit any situation if I just have to sit here in a room and have small talk with people. I don't want it. And what ends up, I usually corner one person, so I find somebody that I can connect with and have some kind of meaningful conversation.
Okay, connect with. This is important because this is my experience. I think this is universally true of force. We really don't have much time for shallow conversation because people who are, we perceive people who go there as just being superficial. What we really want is to be met by another person in the deepest emotional and we go there so fast.
Yeah.
That it's for some people, it's like being on a roller coaster. It's like, you know, going right straight down into the depths, you know?
Yes.
Can scare the bejesus out of people.
Yes. And certainly in my relationships, that is the case. I go 1 to 100 or 0 to 100, whatever it is. In terms of emotional, getting to know somebody on an emotional level, and not really interested in the fact exchange, so to speak, wanting to kind of dig into, always looking for the wound in another person.
Because that's what's interesting.
It is what's
that's
interesting.
That's what's really the most
And I do still feel like that is.
It totally is the most interesting thing.
Interesting.
I am not interested in anything else except tell me about your
accomplishments,
pain.
Whatever. That's
No.
But where do you hurt? Like that's
totally.
That's what I want to know.
Totally.
And so I think, and I've learned to temper that in order to retain some social life.
Right. Yeah, to have a job.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, I've learned to temper it, right?
And well, this is probably why I kept the job that I have. It's because the place where I can actually kind of engage that stuff. But yeah, I would say relationally, intense would be one. At certain times, probably moody.
Mercurial, you mean?
Like mercurial, I mean, just kind of, yeah. I mean, I don't find, and maybe I'm completely in denial about this, but I feel like to some degree, I have some level of sort of almost six-ish type ways of kind of that may seem a little not as mercurial externally. But I think people that really know me know when the weather inside is shifting. And so I would say people in relationships, yeah, I think that would be one thing for sure, is sort of and this place of kind of going inward which is a place I go a lot, and withdrawn and sort of checking out and kind mm-hmm. of, which seems like the kind of the push pull type of thing.
Yes.
Where it's like, okay, I'm engaging and then I'm going to go back into myself. And especially the whole, withdrawing out of a sense of defect. Mm-hmm. And anytime I feel like there's something wrong, I have to work it out, but I'm kind of like a cat. I need to go away by myself and work it out and then come back.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. How does your spouse deal with that?
My former spouse is a 9, and I think in certain ways, I was very difficult mm-hmm. to be with. I think I scared the shit out of her, definitely in the early part of our relationship, in that, you know, I was very expressive, very much knew what I wanted, knew what I thought, what I felt, what I wanted, you know, that whole thing. And I think, and also just like whimsical, sort of like, if I was I'm tired of this town. I want to go back to Atlanta or whatever. And all of a sudden, oh, wait, are we moving to Atlanta now? Like, what's the deal? I'm like, and I'm also very external mm-hmm. in that sense, can be an external processor.
You're preaching to me, brother. Keep going.
So I think that was probably, I'm sure was challenging. I know was challenging, in the sense of, and intense, just like being, everything was intense. Everything
was everything Shakespearean in scope? Was it Wagnerian opera? I mean, was it, you know, was it just everything is a bigger feeling than other people have? It's a bigger,
oh, for sure,
right? Emotive absolutely. Deal, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, yeah, especially in more intimate relationships, I think generally, those are the people that experience the mm-hmm. the sort of that mercurial, you know, shifting and change of weather and all that kind of stuff that happens. I think people on the outside don't see that as much. I think I can be a fairly stoic for, mm-hmm. Or seemingly stoic for. So on the outside, I think I'm perceived sometimes in general, by people who don't know me super well as sort of, you know, quiet and sort of reserved and kind of constant, you know, that way. But certainly people who know me well know a different mm-hmm. aspect, at least.
I definitely have, as a 4, I am moody, and I can, I've learned, though, that as I've gotten older, not in my 20s, drinking crazy, part of that was the need, I just wanted bigger feelings. I mean, I just never met a feeling I didn't want to have, either I didn't want to change, or I didn't want to make bigger, you know, mm-hmm. or to create something bigger out of, you mm-hmm. know. But I think that with myself, sometimes it's not just, I'm not only just sometimes withdrawn because of my own sense of lack, but sometimes in response to what I perceive as lacking and what's lacking in others. Do you know what I mean? Disappointment that, you know,
sure.
of what's missing in others or in the world around me, and then withdrawing as well, you know,
absolutely.
In sort of disappointment. Now, the mood shifts, the weather patterns for me are not as fast moving as they used to be. Mm-hmm. I'm older, been through a lot of stuff, so I've learned a little bit more about equanimity, you know, which the Buddhists talk about really great. I mean, they're just fantastic at describing this state of emotional balance in the presence of whatever life might throw at you. Mm-hmm. Now, as a young man, I had no equanimity, you know, but as a 4, I just know that's my growing plane is always to live with more of a sense of emotional stability, not emotional lability, you know, that crazy roller coaster ride that characterized my earlier years, you know. So just kind of like wrapping up, what do you think, let me ask you this question. What would you want everyone to know about fours?
Well, this is probably a typical four answer in that I feel like
fours, that's why you're here.
fours, I think, are often misunderstood people.
Yes.
And that could be very well my 4 perception of just feeling misunderstood. But I think there is when seen for the rich parts of fours, like what fours can offer. That sort of inner rich landscape that fours often have spent years developing, and know how to navigate in themselves, and I think also well with others. I mean, I've always been the person socially ever since high school. I mostly from my 20s on into now, I'm not the guy you call to come to the party. I'm just not that guy. but I am the guy you call when you're having a divorce or you're going through some horrible crisis in your life. It is just the role that I'm learning to go, that's just what I do. I'm not the guy. You're not going to call me to say, hey, we're going to the, you know, the lake this weekend. And that, you know, because they know probably by now I'm going to be the guy who's going to sit you down and we're going to have a talk about life and what's going on. And, you know, that's just how I work. And I've learned to kind of just be, oh, that's cool. And I do have a great time with my friends. I'm not like Debbie Downer at all. I don't mean to say that. And I don't think fours are that way necessarily if
no.
they're healthier.
Mm-mm. I think it's a cliche.
And I think that's the misunderstanding, yes. is that there is sort of a, you know, kind of like, oh, if you're going to talk about that, you know, it's kind of a down or whatever. I think fours do, they draw, because I think fours see the beauty in all of it, the darker side of like, you know, and so fours are wanting to draw that out in people.
Because they see the tragic meaning. Well, they see the tragic nature of existence. But what draws them to it isn't like this sort of depressed sort of or nihilistic spirit. It's
right.
more like, no, because I know in there I'm going to find the deepest meaning of life.
Yes.
Is in that tragic space.
Yes.
So I think they value what
yeah.
it can bring to us.
Yes. And I think that is, what do I want people to know about fours is that on the positive side, I think fours offer that because fours are not afraid of the grittier stuff. I think they offer not only just the ability to draw out things in other people, the shadowy parts that people are kind of keeping over there in the corner in their little bag, you know, to kind of welcome that out a little bit more for their own sort of work of integration of the darker sides of things.
Mm.
And but to also bring a sense of beauty to it and a sense of redemption even.
Yes.
And I think that's the beauty part of a healthy functioning four is not just being obsessed with the dark, but also having a sense of beauty and some kind of redemptive storyline that can take place. You know, I feel like that's why I say I'm not a pessimist at all. I'm certainly not a nihilist at all. At the core, I believe, you know, in the sort of the Dostoevsky, you know, the world will be redeemed by beauty,
mm-hmm.
you know, I believe that. And so I think, when fours are functioning in their full healthy capacity, I think what they offer is a tremendous, color palette to the emotional landscape and allowing other people to kind of come into their own, kind of rich emotional lives.
Mm.
So in a way, and obviously bringing creative, beautiful work, whether it's a wonderful business that's done well and cares about aesthetics, and you know, and I know that's sort of the snooty can be a snooty part of force.
It can be if they're not healthy, they could be elitist and aloof.
And I think, to see the beauty in that is like, yeah, beauty's wonderful
mm-hmm.
when you care about you know. Aesthetic and you care about how people are experiencing something. I love that. I love people
yep.
that when it doesn't have to be a painting, it can be a restaurant, you know. You know, there's a lot of fours who are starting great restaurants that feel wonderful and people have these wonderful experiences and rich, you know, experiences in how they are enjoying food and the environment, and the atmosphere and the, you know, all of that stuff. And I think that's the beauty that fours bring into the world is this sort of richness, I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, and depth and
pathos.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And relate and relation. You
yeah.
can relate. And like I said, that role that I tend to fill with friends and sometimes people who aren't friends who just have that sense of like, I can tell you stuff, you know, and darker stuff. And I, for whatever reason, some people sense that and that's kind of, and I feel that's cool. I can hang with that. I'm down with keeping that role, I
yeah.
suppose.
I think, it's funny. That's been my experience. I became a therapist and a priest in part because it was natural for me. The priest thing was the liturgy and the Eucharist. It was operating in that metaphorical transcendent plane that moved me. I didn't really care about preaching. It was the Eucharist and the liturgy that
mm-hmm.
blew my mind. You know, that was so beautiful to
me.
And I think as a therapist, it's just because you can pretty much tell me anything and I'm not judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
My mind is like, yeah, life is really hard
mm-hmm.
and we're not consulted about a lot of things that we end up having to wrestle with, you know?
Mm.
And, but let's go digging together to find out what the meaning of this suffering is.
Mm.
You know, what, how can this, how can the lotus grow in the mud, you know, to borrow a Buddhist idea. And yeah, so that it's, you know, there is something beautiful. It's not naive. I'm not being like, oh, you know, finding the pony under the crab. You know what I mean? Sure. It's like, no, I think there's something to be had here that's beautiful.
Absolutely.
You know? So we close out usually our shows with just talking about some tips for folks that are on the journey toward transformation. So here's a couple for fours, and you can throw one in if you'd like, or comment on one. So the first thing I'd tell you, if you're a four and you're beginning to do some spiritual work, the first thing I'd say is to, and this is actually true for every number, but be sure to offer yourself the gift of unconditional self-friendship as you do your work. You know, fours can be very self-critical, really self-critical. They can be, because they are exquisitely attuned not only to beauty but to shame. They are very in touch with shame, that feeling of there's something just really constitutionally busted inside of me, you know. And so they have to be careful when they do their work that they I always tell them to adopt the gaze of the loving mother as you look at yourself and you do your work. It has to, you have to do this work in a climate of compassion, you know. And to not never give up on yourself, because I think fours are prone to giving up on themselves. They do feel misunderstood. I mean, they're, a friend of mine says, you know, fours always feel misunderstood. You know why? Because they are misunderstood. They just are.
That's,
you know,
true.
They're misunderstood by themselves and by others. It's just, you know, why we're always explaining ourselves at great length to people.
Side note, anyone who knows me well, that would be the one thing of just my incurable need to over-explain myself.
Oh, it is a hallmark feature of fours. They can't stop.
That's probably one thing I'm really trying to work on.
Okay, so you understand, like, that's one of the beautiful things about a song, right? Or a, you know, or a book, not so much. But with songs, you only got 3.5-4 minutes to
whittle it
down. Everything you're feeling, something into that. I mean, that's, you know, thank God you see that you have that, because this is why I always tell people, like, with why are fours so drawn to creative fields or the arts, let's say. Well, it's because when you have that overwhelming amount of all the feelings, like this tidal wave of feelings, eventually human language fails to capture what it is you're trying to say. So you've got to find another medium route to get it out, and it has to be somewhat efficient, right? So, you know, music, sculpture, art, dance, whatever it is, you got to find another way to say something that, you know, captures this wild interior emotional thing going on inside, you know? So anyway, unconditional self-friendship. See, we went right off the track right there. I'd say another thing is to also to look for beauty and for meaning, not only in the extraordinary, but also in the ordinary. You know, like, to realize that even, as a friend of mine is a four, says, you know, I've learned to, when I'm even just washing the dishes, to appreciate the warmth of the water. You know, like, like, I don't, everything doesn't need to be some, you know, seismic aesthetic experience to be beautiful, or I don't have to have the extraordinary, just the ordinary. You know, I have a friend of mine who's a four, like, makes herself go to Kroger to buy groceries instead of to the Korean market, you know, where the on the other side of town where only the special food can be bought, you know. And I'd say another one is to remember, and this is a Jack Kornfield quote, I love Jack Kornfield, he says, no emotion is final. And I remind myself of that probably 3 or 4 times a week when I go into one of my funk spaces, you know, or into an anger about something or sadness, whatever. I just go, oh, well, no emotion is final.
That's, you know, also Rilke, you know, feel it all, the beauty and the terror, no feeling is final.
Right.
Just keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's where Jack got it from, no doubt.
I would imagine.
No emotion is final. All right. Well, that's all that we have for today. If you enjoyed our show, or you have some suggestions for future episodes and guests, we'd love to hear from you. You can go to our website, typologypodcast.com, and submit a question or comment. And if you're up for it, please leave a review for us on iTunes. It really helps folks find our show. Matthew, thanks for being on here. I know
my pleasure.
People can get to your website at mpjmusic.com.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're working on a new record right now.
Just wrapping it up, yeah. It should be out in the springtime.
Good.
So, a little ways away, but...
Man, that's going to be good. I'm looking forward to that. Well, friends, until next week, remember the words of the great Oscar Wilde, who too was a 4 on the Enneagram.
Oh, shocker.
Be yourself. Everybody else is already taken. See ya.